Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club, and I'll be moderating this evening's program. Today we bring you an important discussion on matters of international security, featuring advisors to both Senator John McCain and Senator Barack Obama. With the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, dependence on expensive foreign oil, and the increased challenges of dealing with the proliferation of nuclear weapons, America's next president needs a strong vision. Which candidate is best equipped to meet these challenges? Today, we'll get some further insights that you might not be getting from the debates that are occurring. Representing Senator John McCain, and to my immediate left, is the Honorable James Woolsey, Annenberg Distinguished Visiting Fellow at the Hoover Institution and former director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 1993 to 1995. And representing Senator Obama, to my far left, is Dr. Michael McFaul, Deputy Director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. Dr. McFaul is also a Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. I'm going to start us off with a question, and I will encourage you to give me your questions. That's going to form the main meat for our discussion tonight. But I'd like to start off with a question that's very much top of mind for us at the moment. That is, what is the impact of the current international financial crisis on U.S. and global security? And what steps would your candidate take to minimize the impact of the financial crisis on U.S. security? And I invite, this is not a debate, this is a discussion, so I invite either of you to answer and to interact on the question.
Well, I think there are several important implications. One is that because of the fall of the value of the stocks and because of the very difficult situation with bank credit, small businesses and business as a whole are substantially affected. And this creates an understandable focus for most of us on our homes, our families, our mortgages, our ability if we're a small business to continue with that small expansion that we had planned, et cetera. And that is something that will affect if it continues over time and we don't see a rebound both in terms of economic activity and particularly in terms of the credit facilities from the banks give to one another. Could turn us very inward looking and could create a problem in our taking the responsibilities that we need in international affairs. I would only add that although the amount of money here is huge, $700 billion, as an effort to begin to move us away from the crisis, it's important to realize that large as that sum is, some portion of it presumably is going to be recouped if it, for example, goes into investments in individual banks or companies for the federal government, then those then increase in value. Whereas if you look at oil prices from last summer to now, they've ranged between 80-some and $145 a barrel. And at those oil prices, every year we are borrowing and sending to OPEC and other oil exporters $400 to $700 billion. In other words, essentially a crisis a year worth of cost. And we don't get any of that back. So we hope we'll be able to talk about oil and the issues sometime connected with it during these discussions. But I would see those as two very substantial matters.
Mike?
I would agree, and just add two other kinds of threats that come with this financial crisis, and then tell you a little bit about the way Senator Obama is thinking about how to deal with it. The first threat that comes from being a debtor nation, that we are, and the countries that hold our debt, that pay for our deficit, are not necessarily countries that are friendly to our national security interests. They range, and it's not just countries, they're sovereign funds, but they're also companies. But there's a great range. So far, I would say, if we go down, they go down, so we're all in it together. And I'm thinking particularly of the Chinese that finance that expenditure that Jim just talked about. But over time, if we continue along this path, it does make one vulnerable over time. I think it's too early to hit the alarm bells yet. But I think of a country like Iceland right now that was just bailed out by the government of Russia in a very, very major way. Iceland is an ally of the United States. And over time, will that affect the way that Iceland thinks about things like NATO enlargement within the alliance, thinking about policies toward the United States? Too early to tell, but I'm nervous about that kind of exposure that governments have when these sovereign funds that are, Russia and Saudi Arabia and Dubai and China, when they yield such great wealth compared to the countries that need this money. The second thing is what I would call, and again, not to hit the alarm bell yet, but to be worried about it for the future, scapegoating. I just was in Russia a couple weeks ago, and if you watch the Russian news, their financial crisis is all our fault. And it's done deliberately, by the way. And this is a giant master plan. Probably you are doing it. They like to pick on you.
In my old job.
You're still running the world.
Oh,
come on. At least in Moscow. If the whole world goes down, there will be a lot of scapegoating. And we know what happens to that in earlier history. So what is to be done about it? All you have to do is read the New York Times today to see Senator Obama's policy that he announced yesterday. Just to mention it very briefly, one is a stimulus package, very old-fashioned, $50 billion of it, going towards infrastructure development. Two is the tax rebate that he's committed to before, and he's staying with that. Three is home owner relief. He says if you're going to take our money, then you have to not foreclose on us, at least a 90-day period where foreclosure, if there's good faith activity to meet those payments, you're not allowed to do it if you take the government money. Fourth is a change in the 401k rules, the mandatory withdrawals he wants to relax, and he wants to allow people to take $10,000 out without a penalty if they need that stopgap measure. Notice these are things focused at the individual. And then finally, tax relief for individuals and businesses. $500 tax credit if you're under $250,000, if you make less than that, $1,000 for families, and $3,000 in tax relief for every new job created by small businesses. And then finally, the war in Iraq, $10 billion plus a month. Senator Obama is very clear that he sees that as part of being more fiscally responsible, reducing those expenditures. So taken together, I think a rather sound strategy for dealing with what is, and I agree with the premise of your question, not just a crisis for each and every one of us, well, certainly me, but a crisis that affects our national security as well.
Thanks, Jim.
Just a quick word. John McCain's speech on some new approaches with respect to the credit crisis and banking crisis was today rather than yesterday, so you'll see it in tomorrow morning's
Wall Street Journal
paper. But it had a good deal to do with a relief for individual homeowners and utilizing these hundreds of billions of dollars in a way that would affect people's ability to keep their 401ks without having to start spending them at age 70, individual mortgage holder relief, purchasing of mortgages and giving considerably better terms to individuals for their homes and the like. I'll let you read about the details in tomorrow morning's press. Candidates have major differences on Iraq, but when it all comes down to it, it may well be that even though Senator McCain's stance was and has been that we need to wait for developments on the ground to make it possible for us to safely withdraw and not to scuttle this remarkable turnaround that we've seen in the last year and a half, and which I would add I think he is very heavily responsible for because of his pushing of the surge beginning back in the summer of 2003. Nonetheless, the withdrawal in a McCain administration might occur a bit after it would in a Obama administration, but nonetheless, we are headed in a direction such that this $10 billion a month can become minimized relatively quickly, I think, in both cases.
Just following on that for a second, we're going to get somewhat into energy tonight as a security issue, because it's become evident that with the impact on the economy of increasing energy prices, energy is essential to – energy security is essential to American security. Just following up on that, can the Iraqis support their own defense more through – oil revenues that they are receiving?
Surely, and they're headed that direction. It's taken because of the way the Baathists and then later the terrorists blew up oil pipelines and oil production facilities. Iraqi production was quite down for some years, and it was really only with the surge and the suppression of most, if not virtually all, of the both the Sunni and the Shiite terrorist activity that Iraq's production has begun to come back up, and they are beginning now to get into a situation where they can assume a substantially larger share of their own expenditures.
Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's obvious. I mean, when they have surpluses and we have deficits, we should demand more responsibility from them for taking taking control of their own government. And by the way, they seem like they want to do that. You know, the question always from my mind, I mean, if we're going to talk about Iraq, I mean, we obviously, our candidates have very different views about whether it was wise to go in the first place. Senator Obama, I think, is very clear on that. And I think you see the consequences, both in terms of fiscal responsibility and in terms of losing focus on where the real war against the people that really attacked us on September 11th, that is now going badly. And that shouldn't have happened. That was taking our eye off the ball when it was very clear what the strategic objective should have been. Moving forward, I've always wondered, maybe Jim, you could answer this. What would be the definition of victory in Iraq? I've been listening very closely in the debates. I don't know what it would be. Maybe it's too hard to define. But if you don't define, Senator Obama is very, very clear. The strategic objective, if he's president, will be to withdraw from Iraq. How, when, we can talk about, 16 months, one or two brigades a month, the details we can talk about. I don't feel like I'm really qualified to. But the strategic objective is to withdraw. And that, and when McCain speaks, as he did in the presidential debate and the first one, he said, well, the objective is victory. And I'm all for victory, but I just don't know what it means concretely in Iraq.
Well, this is speculative on my part, but I think I would say that a government with the degree of cohesion and stability that we see today and have seen in spite of some military coups over the years in Turkey would provide some kind of a model. Turkey has a Kurdish separatist movement. It is not an entirely a peaceful place, but its traditions of elections and the rule of law tend to dominate over any sense of wanting to conquer its neighbors or anything of that kind. And I think because of the surge and because of the change that began in January of 2007, we are well along the way to something of that sort in Iraq. One can argue about whether we should have gone in the first place or not. Now, I served in the Clinton administration, and we went to war twice in Yugoslavia, once over Bosnia and once over Kosovo, exclusively because of human rights violations. And Milosevic is responsible for approximately one-tenth the number of deaths that Saddam Hussein was responsible for, if you count the victims of the wars he started, and I think you should. He had about 10 times the number of people killed, as did Milosevic. Admittedly, we were lucky with respect to what we had to do in former Yugoslavia, and we were able to fight both of those wars from the air. I stand second to no one in my criticism of the Bush administration's handling of this war from the summer of 2003 until they finally listened to John McCain and adopted his strategy in January of 2007. I might add that Senator Obama was not in favor of that, and have, as a result, turned this around. But it is still fragile. It could still come apart. And that's the reason, I think, that John McCain is in favor of not having a date certain, but rather continuing to press the Iraqis to take over more and more, as they are doing, and for us to scale down as they scale up, and certainly for them to assume as much financial burden as is feasible.
So let's assume the U.S. does wind things up in Iraq at some point in the next year, 16 months, 2 years, whatever. What do your respective candidates feel are the strategies for ensuring that Iraq does not again become a threat to the U.S. or international security through harboring terrorists, through creating instability in the region, through continued conflict inside the country, or other activities that would challenge stability? What's beyond the troop pullout in terms of managing Iraq?
Thank you. Well, that's a speculation 2 or 3 years into an administration that doesn't exist, so I'm going to be careful and not speculate. But I do want to point out that this was not a terrorist haven until we invaded Iraq. I do want to point out, I don't think James was implying this, but that the central reason why we went to war in Iraq was not for humanitarian reasons. If that were the case, we would have invaded a lot earlier. In fact, we should have invaded during the Clinton administration. That was not the case that was made. That was afterwards. And I would say more generally, I'm writing a book about military interventions from the very beginning of the American Republic and our attitudes about this. And I would say, as a law of American kind of philosophy about the world, we never invade a country in the interests of democracy promotion. I think, you know, the two you describe are some of the exceptions to the rule, and very good exceptions, by the way, that I supported at the time in the Balkans. But it's never, we don't do regime change by invading countries. Never. Because the American people won't support that. They never have. That what's the paradox is, once we get into a country for whatever reason, and in this case for a rather set of bogus reasons, I believe, then I think it is part of the American character to never try to leave until we've tried to affect democratic change and make the institutions more democratic, more liberal, going all the way back to the Philippines. And that is a paradox of American power, which therefore requires, for me, a very, very high threshold for when you use American military force that I do not think was met in the run-up to the war in Iraq.
Can I just insert a qualification? I probably shouldn't do this, but you're saying that we have not engaged in military action for regime change except when attacked or threatened, because clearly World War II was about regime change.
Exactly.
In Germany and Japan.
We did not invade to overthrow the Nazi regime. Let's be very clear about that. We did not do that. We waited. We stood on, you know, we watched when gross, I mean, whether we had the capacity or not is a different debate. But if you look at all, every single time, we get in for national security reasons. And that's because the American people, look at the public opinion polls very closely, they don't support the idea of using military force to promote regime change abroad.
Jim?
I think Mike is right that regime change standing alone, other than in a few small cases such as Grenada and Panama back in the Reagan administration and so forth, has generally not been the sole rationale for our using force. But on the other hand, we certainly never thought that we could succeed in World War II or any other war without effectively bringing about regime change. And we had, and we have democracies in Japan, Germany, and Italy today to show for the fact that we persisted in that. And indeed, at the beginning of those wars, we started planning about how we were going to bring democracy to those three countries. It's important to realize, I think, that there were really three rationales going around in the government for the invasion of Iraq back in 2003. There was the one that was publicized because the administration decided tactically that would be the best thing to raise, given the United Nations' interest in the issue and so forth, was weapons of mass destruction. But also the support for terrorism in general, not specifically al-Qaeda, but Saddam's ties with a number of terrorist groups were very real, and especially the humanitarian concerns. And these all were part of a kind of a stew of rationales. I think that the great failure of the Bush administration was not that it decided to free Iraq. I think if you talk to most any Iraqi today, unless he's still a committed Ba'athist or a terrorist, he's very glad that the United States freed Iraq from the Ba'athist regime. The mistake, I think, was in not following John McCain's advice in the summer of 2003 and fighting this successfully by protecting the people and living among them and having the adequate forces to do that. And the other failure was in trying to occupy Iraq and give them a constitution that we drafted. Bernard Lewis and I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a very few months after, in September, I think, of 2003, after the invasion, saying, stop this nonsense of trying to draft a constitution for the Iraqis. The Iraqis have a perfectly fine constitution, which was indigenous to them. It was their 1923 constitution, which was a constitutional monarchy, had a fine Bill of Rights, had an elected lower house, had an appointed upper house, yes, and had a constitutional monarch, Hashemite king. If we give them back the constitution they drafted and which was an indigenous part of their constitutional government for over two decades until the late 50s, or three decades, we would be showing the Arab and Muslim world that we respect their tradition and their culture and their history. Now, I think had we done that and had we followed John McCain's advice on strategy, we would not have had the extraordinarily painful 3.5 years of the very, very terrible fighting that occurred and which has so soured people on the war. But I think one needs to look back to the Saddam Hussein regime and really ask oneself, are we really sorry that's gone? I don't think we should be.
But I want to be very clear on this. I'm not sorry Saddam Hussein's gone either. That's great. I think you have to ask, what are the costs and benefits to American national security that we have incurred as a result of that? Now, you pose a hypothetical. Maybe if John McCain were president and done everything right, you would have got something, although I'm skeptical, but I think it would have been a lot better than the total disaster of the Bush administration. So on this, we totally agree. I'm willing to accept that proposition, but I want to remind you that American lives were going to be lost even in the best of worlds. Iraqi lives were going to be lost in the best of worlds. And when you look at the totals now and you say, now are we safer today as a result of this? After over 4,000 American lives, tens of thousands of Iraqis that have been dead. There's a big debate, by the way, in the opinion poll data about whether they think they're better off today than they were before this war. If you've lost somebody in this war, you have a very different attitude than if thinking about it just generally. And when I ask myself, I have two boys, 5 and 10, would I give up one of them for the incremental betterment that we are today as a result of 5 years of fighting in Iraq? My answer is unequivocally no, that was a strategic blunder. And I'm not even mentioning all the other residual things that have come from that war. Who is the strongest country in the region as a result of that war? It's Iran. Iran's going to dominate Iraq for decades to come. That I'm quite confident in predicting. Look at what's happened to all other security fronts and issues that we should have been focusing on. We haven't been focusing on them because of the singular focus on Iraq. And then you look at our standing in the world today. Some people think that that doesn't matter. I happen to think it matters a lot. If people trust you, if people value you, if people look up to you as a leader, your ability to get things done in the American national interest, that is for us, for my mother in Montana, for you here in San Francisco, goes up. And that leverage is something that we squandered dearly because of this war in Iraq.
Well, I do agree the Bush administration fought it wrong for 3.5 years, but I think it's quite clear from what happened from January of 07 until today as a result of the surge and the complete change in strategy at John McCain's behest. What could have been the case had that war been fought well from the beginning? And I just fundamentally disagree that Iran's going to dominate Iraq for years to come. We have a lot to disagree about with respect to that, but we'll let you go on to whatever question
we
you
actually
want
have
to,
a lot of ahead. Iran questions, but there's a very good question from the audience which I wanted to pose. Given the current fiscal crisis, budget deficit, and the need for economic stimulus, is there any consideration of reducing the defense budget, at least regarding expenditures for expensive new weapon systems? After all, the current war was kicked off when we got attacked by a small group armed only with box cutters.
Who do you want to go first?
You guys go first.
I think the answer is that we have, with respect to some of these weapon systems, made the terrible mistake of thinking that if you keep adding capability and they get exponentially more expensive, it won't be a problem even if you don't have very many. The Navy gives a good example of this. They have recently canceled a new destroyer, the DDX, which was going to end up costing several billion dollars per copy for a destroyer. It's stunning that it got that far. The current chief of naval operations had the wisdom, along with the Secretary of Defense, to cancel a project like that. John McCain has a very strong record in fighting waste in the Department of Defense. He took on his own party and nominees of his people he knew well in order to set aside the procurement of the tanker several years ago that ended up with prosecutions putting several people in jail. He's a strong and well-known enemy of waste in defense, and I have every confidence that if he's president, he'll do a good job and have a good Secretary of Defense and team that will impose economy and focus on some of the types of forces that Bob Gates has actually been talking about that we may well need for wars to come that are distinct from the extremely high technology, extremely expensive platform forces.
Mike?
I would just say at a higher level of thinking about Senator Obama's approach to foreign policy is he, and he said this very explicitly, and I can get you all the websites for those afterwards. I can tell you exactly where all this is on our website. But his philosophy about the American instruments for using our power abroad is that we've got to realign them, that there's been too much focus on the military as our only instrument of American power, at the expense of other things, diplomacy, economic assistance, democracy assistance, even, by the way. And he wants to readjust that portfolio so that we're putting more money into these other things and not so much money just focus on the military as a kind of strategic way of thinking about it. Now, what weapon systems need to be cut and how to make that balance different, that's a debate for later. But if you look at it, this is the way he talks about it. So he wants to make economic assistance, not just some backwater of American foreign policy, right? The administrator of the Agency for International Development. I think tells you everything that you need to know about how we've configured our government to do the post-regime change reconstruction and development, right? So what do we do when the President Bush, irrespective of where you're at on the debate about whether it was a good decision or not, but when President Bush decides, okay, we are going to destroy the regime of Saddam Hussein, he knows exactly who to call. He knew who to call. Secretary Rumsfeld, member of his cabinet. He sits over there at a giant building. You've been there, right? The Pentagon, with hundreds of billions of resources and with, in my opinion, some of the best and brightest people that work in the U.S. government, because they have a system that where they take somebody who's an 18-year-old kid and they make him a general, and they have a system of rewards, truly impressive what they do. He says, okay, that your job is to destroy the regime of Saddam Hussein. Mission accomplished, April 9th, 2003. Who does he call then for the plan for regime construction? That was for regime destruction. Who does he call? First of all, as Jim's pointed out, that should have been planned years in advance. I think Japan started in 1942, the occupation, the planning for Japan. That should have been planned way in advance. And it wasn't. It was a pickup team. And I know because some of my colleagues were called upon months after the collapse of the regime to go and reconfigure the plans for what we do afterwards. So we agree on that. But we're just going to keep making that same mistake again and again and again if we don't reconfigure our government for dealing with these kinds of problems. In my case, you know, I would hope that they would be non-military situations.
I'd only add that I agree, and John McCain's made several speeches about the importance of restructuring USIA and the diplomatic corps and economic development of the sort that we should have done in Afghanistan after we helped overthrow the Taliban and did not. There are just a whole range of these things that both the Iraq and the Afghan war, I think, have pointed out, and I'd have to say both candidates have made major statements on how these types of changes have to occur within the United States government to broaden the responsibility for this sort of what used to be derogatorily called nation building, but I don't think nation building is a nasty term. Sometimes we have to do it.
You know, it's we may have to consider the possibility that in our current financial situation, the prospects for foreign assistance and a U.S. Role, a significant U.S. role in that area may not be that high. Nonetheless, the Bush administration has had actually an assistance initiative in the Middle East called the Greater Middle East Initiative, whose mission is to pursue fundamental change in the Middle East. Greater secularization of the societies, better status for women, support of science and technology, essentially trying to change the roots in the society that produce the madrasas and radical Islam and terrorism. So what do you think of the Greater Middle East Initiative? How has it worked? Would your candidate continue it? Is it prudent to pursue this type of fundamental change in the Middle East?
I believe the answer is yes, but one cannot principally do it with force. And as long as one is bucking up against the Wahhabi-funded madrasas, whether in the West Bank or in Pakistan or wherever, one is not going to succeed without extraordinary effort. Now, we, as I said, borrow $400 to $700 billion a year to import oil, and a fair chunk of that from us and other oil importers goes to OPEC, a large share of that to the Saudis, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And as a result of that, if you take the form of Islam in Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism, which is effectively somewhere between murderous and genocidal with respect to Shiite, Muslims, Jews, homosexuals, and apostates, and massively repressive of everyone else, including particularly women. It's essentially Al-Qaeda's ideology. Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabis disagree only about who should be in charge, whether one should serve the House of Saud or one should fly planes into buildings whenever one wants. They don't disagree about the substance. In Lawrence Wright's The Blooming Tower, which I think is the best book about 9/11, Wright says that with a little over 1% of the world's Muslims, the Saudis control some 90% of the world's Islamic institutions. So the chances are very, very good, 90% or so, that that madrasa in the West Bank or in Pakistan is being funded by Wahhabi sources of one sort or another. If you want to know who's responsible for that, if you want to know who's paying for that, I suggest you do the same thing I do when you pull into a filling station. Try to take just a few seconds before you get out to charge your gas, turn the rearview mirror, and look just for a moment into your own eyes. Now you know who is paying for those little boys in Pakistan and the West Bank to be taught by Wahhabis to be suicide bombers. We will not succeed until we break oil's power, until we break oil's dominance of transportation, and we can do that with a reasonable plan. We got some difficult days to get through getting there. We've got to figure out how to do it. But we can do it, and once that begins to happen, we will begin to see some, I think, possibilities of making these kinds of helping Arabs and Muslims in that part of the world make those kinds of changes if we let them do it according to their own traditions, like the 1923 Iraqi Constitution.
Mike.
So I think the general idea that the United States should support the transfer of ideas about democracy and civil liberties and be in that strategic game is very important. I would say my assessment, again, I'm writing about this as we speak, my assessment of the Bush administration, you know, D minus maybe C plus at the end of the day. We need to learn from their mistakes. The first mistake, let's just be clear, was that they didn't come to Washington to do this. When I spent a couple hours with the president right before his first trip abroad, without revealing any confidentiality, I did not come out of that meeting. Vice President Cheney was there, Condoleezza Rice was there, the whole team. I did not come out of that meeting, and you witnessed it on the campaign trail, thinking that this administration was going to be devoted to democracy and human rights. They had other things that they were focused on. Unlike Senator McCain, by the way, I want to be clear on that. Senator McCain is the head of the International Republican Institute. I first briefed him in Russia in 1996 when he was a monitor there for elections. I think he has a very sound, solid track record on these issues. Bush administration did not. And it was only after September 11th when they then discovered that this, what I think to be an important strategic, should be an important strategic focus of the United States. And the fact that they were learning it on the fly and doing it as they were going along, I think, is illustrated in the rather spotty track record that they have. So the Greater Middle East Initiative, there are less people living in freedom today in the Middle East than there were in 2001. That's according to Freedom House. That's not my figures. That's their figures. I think they had the right intentions. President Bush most certainly, I think, believes this, but didn't invest in a real strategy for trying to do it. And the worst thing you can do is that. So the worst thing you can do is give a speech. His second inaugural, I think he mentioned the word freedom 23 times. Who's counting? But 23 times, liberty, I think, 12, and democracy 3 times. Great speech. And then Secretary Rice, our colleague, we will welcome her back very shortly, by the way. I should think about what I'm about to say.
She might be your provost, so I'm trying to...
She won't be my provost, but she will be our colleague at Hoover, and she will be in my Department of Political Science. We welcome her back. It'll be great to have her back. A lot to learn from her. But she went to Cairo. She gave a great speech. She said, you guys should reform. And then that was it. And so they did a little things. They did a few machinations. They had a presidential election. And now the man who ran, Ayman Nour, who ran for president, sits in jail. And we do absolutely nothing about it. So if you can't get Ayman Nour out of jail with a country that you subsidized to the tune of $1.5 to $1.8 billion a year, if you can't even get him out of jail, you can't tell me you're serious about promoting democracy from Morocco to Iran. It just doesn't ring true as a grand strategy.
Let me just add one point. First of all, I agree with every word Mike said. Secondly, the model here ought to be Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly, carry a big stick, not bluster, and then say, I won't tolerate this, I won't tolerate that, and not come across. That's the worst thing to do, and the Bush administration's done that many times. The main point I want to make, though, is that we shouldn't believe that because of the difficulties and the special problems in the Middle East, that the spread of democracy around the world, much of it under our influence, is a hopeless task. The world, I'm former chairman of the board of Freedom House, and using Freedom House numbers, the world went from about 20 democracies in 1945 to about 120 today. Now, about 30 of those have a lot of corruption and some problems with the rule of law, but they're like Indonesia. They have regular elections now. And so about 60% of the world's governments and 60% of the world's people live under democracy. That's a remarkable change. About 35 to 40 countries are partly free. They're like Jordan. They aren't oppressive particularly, but they don't have really representative democratic institutions. And another 35 to 40 are dictatorships or really autocratic kingdoms. Many of these are in the Middle East. And there have been setbacks for democracy in parts of the Middle East, and oil is a big part of the reason. Tom Friedman says it very well. He says, the price of oil and the path of freedom run in directly opposite directions. Oil or any kind of a substance with a huge amount of economic rent attached to it, coming into an autocratic country tends to enhance the power of the autocratic central regime. And that's a big part of the problem in the Middle East and that part of the world. But it doesn't mean that spreading democracy through example, through influence, through help, through various methods is a mug's game. We've actually, along with our allies, done a pretty good job net from 1945 forward.
For our listeners,
we didn't get to Barack Obama.
For our listeners and viewers, let me just mention that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Today, our speakers are advisors to Senators John McCain and Barack Obama. We're talking about international security. Representing Senator McCain is James Woolsey, former CIA director, and representing Senator Obama is Dr. Mike McFaul, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Now, Mike.
Just if I may, because I was just talking about Bush, I forgot about Barack Obama.
I sometimes do, too.
Just on the Freedom House scores, just realize that's absolutely right, the greatest growth in the history of the modern world over the last 30 years, but then it flatlined for the Bush administration. You can go to the Freedom House website and see it. It flatlined.
That's right.
Some pluses, some minuses, but on the average over the 8 years. And in the Middle East, it's gone down. So what would Barack Obama do differently, I think, is important, because we agree on the objectives, it sounds like. And it sounds like we also agree on the mishaps of the Bush administration. He said a number of things. And again, one of the first documents I worked on for him a year and a half ago when I first joined was a document about democracy and development. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention lately because of other big states and big problems. But it's called Strengthening Our Common Security by Investing in Our Common Humanity. 12-page document outlining a big strategy. Let me just give you the highlights. One, we got to get our own democracy here at home in order first. You have to fix a lot of the problems. And by the way, Freedom House has just published an excellent book called America, How Free, detailing this. I think, full disclosure, I'm now on the board of Freedom House now. But this was an idea maybe that came up when you were there because it was before my time. Very excellent book. And you can't go to Tehran or Beijing or Moscow, three places I've been in the last several years, and talk about why you should be doing democracy when you've got the mess of democracy and the violation of human rights that we have been responsible for here at home. So that's the first thing, get our own house in order. Two, Barack Obama, you got to remember, is an activist. He's an NGO leader. That's his worldview. And in my conversations with him about Russia and Russian democracy, you get this view of somebody that understands it's not just all about states that are going to change things, but non-governmental actors have to be part of the equation. And when it comes to democracy assistance, his paper is very clear that it needs to be the lead, not behind the state. And a lot of the Bush administration's initiative, quite frankly, has been to put more money at the State Department. The Middle East Partnership Initiative, for instance, the flagship program of the Greater Middle East Initiative that you mentioned, Gloria, sits in the State Department. Well, that's a problem if you're an Iranian NGO trying to do work. You don't want to take money directly from the State Department. You want to be involved with groups like the Freedom House, with groups like the National Endowment for Democracy, or I would say, and this is just my own personal opinion, even groups farther removed outside of Washington. You know, there are non-governmental organizations even here in California. I know our friends in Washington forget. But that, to me, would be a part of it. Third, idea of what Senator Obama and Senator Biden call a democratic dividend. You make a transition to democracy, you should be rewarded for that difficult transition. And the legislation that they have sponsored on this is directed toward Pakistan right now, where they want to triple the non-military assistance to the newly democratic government of Pakistan. And the idea is a very simple one. After you make a transition, those are when you're hard-pressed. We know the data that if you do not perform economically, your probability of surviving goes down 5 times. I should have brought the data. This is what I teach at Stanford. I think, you know, with a growth rate of 0 to 1%, you have a probability of surviving, 0.2 10 years out from a democratic transition. And if you grow at 3 or higher, probability goes up to 0.7. So the idea is give money to the new Democrats when they make the transition. And then finally, when it comes to difficult countries, Barack Obama is very explicit about this, that we have to have engagement with nasty countries and nasty individuals for our national security interests. But that doesn't mean we check our values at the door to talk to a Vladimir Putin or the regime in Iran. Big mistake that President Bush made, in my opinion, that when he went to Slovenia in 2001, he thought he had to make Vladimir Putin his buddy, right? He looked into his soul and he saw somebody he could trust. And that's because he wanted to get missile defense done, by the way. That was not some mistake. That was something very calculating. I think that's a big strategic mistake. We don't have friends and buddies who are leaders. We have relationships with governments, whether it's Russia or even Georgia, for that matter. And that you have to do for American national interests. And in parallel, when you're doing that, actually having a better state-to-state relationship can facilitate this non-governmental stuff. It's called track two diplomacy, dual track diplomacy. And our colleague George Shultz writes about this brilliantly in his memoir for how they dealt with the Soviets. I think that is a roadmap for how to deal with states like Russia and Iran looking to the future.
We'll move to another topic.
Make a very brief one. John McCain said he looked into Putin's eyes too, and he saw three letters: K, G, and B. I don't disagree with much of what Mike said, and John McCain has similar approaches and ideas. I think it is important that we parse the word engagement a little in dealing with regimes, especially the most hideous regimes, such as that of North Korea and Iran and Syria and Cuba and Venezuela. It's one thing for your diplomats, even your foreign ministers, or in some cases your intelligence officers, to talk to one another and to engage in the sense of talking. But one should not interpret engagement in this context as a state preliminary to marriage. One should, I think, be very, very cautious about having summits, head of state to head of state discussions, unconditionally with people like Kim Jong-il and Ahmadinejad. That was an original suggestion, not more than a suggestion. It was a statement on two occasions by Senator Obama. He has since, it sounds to me, I think probably under the wise counsel of people like Mike, backed off of that. I'm glad, because we had engagement in 1961 with a very bright, articulate young president without a great deal of experience in foreign policy. And Nikita Khrushchev felt he had taken John Kennedy's measure and, as a result, pushed in both Berlin and with the Cuban Missile Crisis and brought the world to the brink of nuclear war. John Kennedy managed that crisis well, but the events from the spring, summer of 61 with their summit to unconditional summit through the Cuban Missile Crisis were not a calm period in American history. And I think that it is important for us to make sure that we stay in touch with these different countries. There are lots of ways to do that at all sorts of different levels, but summits unconditionally with the world's worst dictators, including the world's most prominent Holocaust denier, strike me as not a good idea.
So, actually, we need to, if I may, because this is actually where we do, our candidates do disagree rather fundamentally. So let's just be clear. I don't recall the word summit ever coming out of Barack Obama's mouth.
So personally, he said personally. It's pretty summity.
The policy, just to be clear, and it's different. It's a fundamental difference, and it has to do with Iran and Russia, by the way, where Senator McCain believes that you can somehow not deal with these leaders, you know, kick Russia out of the G8 is his, you know, bumper sticker for how to deal with Russia, and then expect that you're going to have a constructive relationship about our national security interests. And so with both places, and Iran, I mean, my goodness, we have tried the policy of not talking to the regime for four decades now. And in that, if I just may finish, okay, and then you could, I mean, it's really.
They sound like the candidates.
She said we sound like the candidates.
Well, but I think it's rather important, and I think it expresses a philosophical difference, and I hope we can get the kind of bigger stuff about philosophical differences and then the ways of approaching it, because I don't think Barack Obama for a minute thinks, first of all, he's not going to meet with Ahmadinejad. He's made that very clear, that he's not the guy in charge of their nuclear program, so why would you meet with him anyway? But second, that it doesn't – what are do we lose by putting out with a new administration that it is time to begin to talk to this regime? We're not going to check our values at the door. We're not going to make the mistakes from 1961. But the notion of just, well, we're waiting until you change before we talk, as they continue to acquire the technology to make a nuclear weapon, I just think is irresponsible.
Just to be clear.
And if I may finish, last thing, if and when we have to do more coercive things, we will be better served by doing what Barack Obama believes than just standing unilaterally against everybody else who wants us to talk. I think we'll be in a much better position to do the coercive things that if, and God forbid, they are necessary, we're going to have the world with us if we try this other track first.
I guess the rest of us...
You get the rest of the time. I'll stop. I've taken all my time.
I guess the rest of us have to get used to the fact that academics sometimes talk in 50-minute segments. But just to be clear, John McCain is not opposed to engagement in the sense of discussion. He's not opposed to diplomatic contacts, and he's not opposed to talking to these various regimes using various American officials. What he is opposed to is what Senator Obama said on two occasions he wanted to do, which was to have unconditional personal meetings with heads of state in North Korea, Iran, and he can choose between Khamenei and Ahmadinejad, whichever one he thinks is more important. It's still a summit meeting, or Chavez, or Castro, or Assad. Personal meetings by the head of the United States government unconditionally, which Senator Obama said on two occasions he would do, is a really, really naive, nutty idea. Now, I take everything Mike said literally when he talked about the importance of engagement, discussions, meeting, fine. And John McCain does not have a problem with a government which he heads having discussions of different diplomatic types with these countries. He is adamantly opposed to a summit unconditional meeting with leaders like Ahmadinejad or Khamenei, Kim Jong-il, etc. He thinks that would be a terrible decision by the United States president. With other countries, he has said that many times.
Okay.
With other countries, such as Russia, he has not said that there should be no top-level contact. There may be top-level meetings, at the presidential head of state level, with other countries where we have disagreements. But the five that Senator Obama mentioned where he would have a head of state, person-to-person, unconditional meeting, John McCain has said time and time again he thinks that is a terrible idea, and I think most of the rest of us should too.
You know, I think we should move on, because I think the views are very clear on that point.
Well, just one
wait,
last thing,
no,
though.
No, okay, I think mind, we, there's,
they're clear.
We need to cover some other issues. And the one I'd like to get to is the question of energy policy, because it's become so clear to us that our we have vulnerabilities as a result of our dependence on oil. So with the in the case of each of your candidates, what would be their optimum energy policy for American security? How much dependence on foreign sources, particularly oil? What role for nuclear power? What new sources of energy? What role for renewables? What new sources of fossil fuels? And the timetable for implementing a new energy policy?
You have two energy systems, essentially, in the United States. You have transportation, which is 97% powered by oil, and well over 75% of the world's oil is in one way or another in the hands of OPEC. So OPEC dominates oil, and oil dominates transportation. The problem with oil is that OPEC can set the price, and they can adjust the flow. And so what we have to do is break oil's monopoly over transportation. John McCain thinks the way to do that is to emphasize particularly electricity in the form of things like plug-in hybrids and alternative liquid fuels such as particularly from biomass and waste feedstock such as ethanol, butanol, methanol, the alcohol fuels by requiring flexible fuel vehicles from American and other manufacturers that can use those fuels. It costs less than $100 a car. It's essentially negligible. As we move decisively away from oil, he very much believes that domestic production is better than foreign production if you can do it in an environmentally sound way. He believes that that is possible with respect to outer continental shelf drilling. He's not in favor of drilling in ANWR in Alaska. But he does believe that outer shelf, continental shelf drilling is safe and has been proven that way by the new technologies over the years since the Santa Barbara spill of 39 years ago. And he supports that. Every $1 billion that we use to produce oil domestically instead of buying it overseas is about 10,000 American jobs. So as an interim basis, drilling, yes, but only as an interim basis because it just works on that problem. It doesn't work on the overall problem of destroying oil's strategic position. With respect to electricity, he thinks it's extremely important to have a mandatory carbon cap and trade system. He was the first major figure in the Congress, along with his friend Joe Lieberman, to propose this back at the beginning of the decade. He and Senator Obama disagree about one aspect of mandatory cap and trade, but they do agree there should be a mandatory cap and trade system. John McCain took on his party. He took on the oil and coal interests. He took on the president, all on this issue because he believes it's important to do something about climate change and to move away from emitting so much CO2 into the atmosphere. That would be, there are other steps, but that would be the major step he would take with respect to changing the way we produce electricity.
Mike.
So I don't think there's a big disagreement here. In fact, James Woolsey has been one of the innovators, and we're glad to have you out here in the land of innovation, by the way, now, where you belong, because this is we will change this problem. I'm absolutely convinced of it. Silicon Valley, I mean. We're going to change it. It's not going to – Washington needs to help, but I'm absolutely convinced that this will be the next big technological revolution, and we will be ahead of it, not behind it. And I was just looking, as you talked, I'm looking at our statement on New Energy for America. We agree, you know, help create 5 million new jobs and strategically by investing $150 billion in green jobs, as Senator Obama said. He announced that in his speech at Denver. Plug-in hybrids, 1 million by the year 2015. Cap and trade. There's really I can't find anything that we disagree with
here. There's a lot of overlap.
I think that's really, really good. because this has to be a bipartisan thing. It has to be the kind of way that we dealt with dealing with communism during the Cold War. I think it really demands that kind of level of attention. And the fact that we do with the two candidates we have now, not with all the candidates, by the way.
Right.
And I want to make sure everybody understands that if I were in the Republican Party, John McCain would have been my candidate for sure. There's no doubt about it. I think, and I find this for my own self, as somebody who deals with democracy abroad, the very process has been a renewal of the democratic process. That we produce, I think, the two best candidates in the party is really good for the long term. And this, I think, will be the strategic challenge of our time. And I'm actually quite optimistic that we have the bipartisan support to do it right.
So I agree.
Very briefly, nuclear power, yes or no?
Well, Senator McCain has said that he thinks we need to move toward producing some 40 nuclear reactors for nuclear power over the course of the next 20-plus years. There's a reason for that, which is that we need to do everything we can, he believes, with respect to energy efficiency and renewables. Natural gas is really needed to balance renewables because solar and wind are intermittent, and one operates in the daytime entirely, the other operates largely at night. Natural gas can be turned on and off, and so you need it to balance. And you can't really use natural gas, Boone Pickens to the contrary notwithstanding, and use it all for automobile fuel and neglect its role in needing to help renewables. So you're left by needing some type of baseload power in order to replace particularly some of the nuclear reactors that are going to go offline that were built back in the 60s and replace some of the coal-fired power plants that cannot either capture or sequester their carbon. If you look around for something that is clean and that we know how to do, although you do have a nuclear waste issue, you've got to figure out how to dispose of it. That's a political issue. It's not a substantive one, basically. We know how to build nuclear reactors, and they are a reasonable way to deploy what baseload we need. But the first choice ought to be efficiency and renewables and natural gas to help renewables.
Mike?
Senator Obama agrees, but with the caveat of that the last part that is political is very hard. That is guiding and knowing where the nuclear fuel is in the world and where to store it is something he's been very focused on from his first days in the Senate.
And there are obviously issues of proliferation, safety, waste disposal that have to be addressed as we move forward or if we move forward with nuclear power. There are so many countries and regions we could talk about. We haven't talked about North Korea. But just to pick one of America's truly crucial relationships, how do your candidates believe U.S. policy towards Russia should change in light of the more assertive Russia we've seen over the past year or two? What new approaches would your candidates' administration take in relations with Russia?
This is probably an issue on which Senator Obama and Senator McCain have some difference. I don't think it's gigantic, but I think it probably is there. Senator McCain, if you read his statements about China and his statements about Russia, the ones about Russia are sterner. The ones about China are somewhat more hopeful. They're cautious, but they're somewhat more hopeful. And he has, I think, seen that as oil has increased in price, Tom Friedman's line about the price of oil and the path of freedom running in opposite directions has been borne out. Putin has felt his oats more and more, whether it's using cyber attacks against Estonia or and Georgia, leaning on Ukraine, leaning on Moldova, invading Georgia, that we have a Russia here that is performing very much like the czars of old. Happily, their ideology is no longer something that drives them the way it, at least to some extent, did back from 1917 on through part of the Cold War anyway. But they are exerting power against their neighbors in extraordinarily inappropriate ways. He believes that needs to be dealt with firmly. He certainly is willing to talk with Russia, to be cordial to Russia, but he believes this leader of Russia is throwing his weight around much more than is good for the safety and security of countries bordering Russia and our allies in Europe.
Mike.
Thank you, Gloria. Actually, Russia is one of the things I have direct responsibility for in our campaign, so I appreciate the question. I would say on the diagnostics, there's really no difference between Senator McCain and Senator Obama about the problem that we just heard described. As Russia has become more autocratic, Russia has become more bellicose to its neighbors, and that's not an accident. I think Senator Obama has been very clear about that long before Russia invaded Georgia. As to how to deal with Russia, I think it's a very complex problem that requires a complex strategy. And the essence of it in this order, and importantly in this order, are the following. First, you got to make sure that democracy in Ukraine and Georgia do not fail, especially in Georgia. The assault and stress they are under right now, and that's why Senator Obama supported a billion-dollar package first introduced by Senator Biden to help rebuild Georgia. Ukraine also needs to be bolstered right now. He's called for a tripling of assistance to Ukraine right now. Second, you have to deal with Russia with one voice from the West. The mess at Bucharest at the NATO summit, where we were saying one thing and our German friends and our French friends were saying something else, that's exactly what the Russian government wants to hear from us. So whatever we do in terms of a policy towards Russia, we have to speak with one voice first and foremost. We have to get the alliance strengthened. Third, energy diversity. This, Gloria, is, you know, this is part of the same thing. Great. Just as we're talking about our dependence on the countries that we receive oil from, we have to reduce the dependence of our allies and partners in the region through energy efficiency, through alternative energy, and through alternative pipeline routes so that we reduce their dependence. And then finally, of course, we have to deal with Russia on issues of the ones you just mentioned on our nuclear arsenals. We have to get serious about that again. A lot of inattention over the last few years. Nonproliferation. We have to deal directly with Russia on those. Even Iran, by the way, we have to deal directly. No side deals. I think that's really naive to think that if we give them Georgia, they're going to give us a vote at the UN Security Council. That is a really, really bad idea. Doesn't work historically, will not work with this regime. But we have to have a frank conversation with them about our interests and not let those first three things that I just mentioned be sacrificed in the name of a good relationship with the leader in the Kremlin.
Last question. We're at that point in the program. Many administrations have a single phrase that expresses their approach to foreign and security policy. In the Clinton administration, the descriptor was engagement. How would you characterize your candidate's approach? Was such a word or phrase describing his overall concept or the first principles of foreign and security policy he would follow?
John McCain has said it himself in a major speech some months ago. He said he pleads guilty to being an idealist, but he is a realistic idealist. So it's realistic idealism. He believes in standing firm for our values. He did it as a prisoner of war. He's done it time and time again in taking on his own party and his party's president on issues such as torture, campaign finance, climate change, immigration. This is a man who is willing to take tough decisions and stand behind them. We're all flawed human beings. But this is an extraordinarily brave and principled man, and I think, in my judgment, realistic idealism characterizes his view as well.
Mike?
You know, I've written a book, actually two books, about the realists versus the idealists and the making of American foreign policy. And in your party, it's the realists versus the neocons, and my party, it's the realists versus the Wilsonian liberals. And if there's one thing you remember from our discussion tonight, that debate internally, I think, is as robust, if not more robust, than the debate between the parties. I think that's really misunderstood, and that's why I wrote the books about it.
Okay,
but
so the word or the phrase?
So having said that, I'm going to just tell you an anecdote, because his reaction to you would be, I'm categorically against a bumper sticker. This is not the Cold War. This is not a time when you can just have a phrase and organize all these things. That was the mistake of the Bush administration, that ridiculous phrase, the global war on terror, which made no sense in terms of organizing our strategic objectives. And when I had the chance, Gloria, to spend a good chunk of time with Senator Obama, it was right after he got back from vacation. Because of my dealings with Russia, we spent a plane ride talking about grand strategy. And I like these labels. This is what, you know, this is what we do in academia, right? This is what I write about. Liberals, are you a neocon? Are you a principled guy? I'm a Wilsonian liberal, to be clear. I'm in that camp in my party. Try as I may to pin him down, he's like, no, that is not useful for dealing with the myriad of strategic threats that we've just been discussing for the last hour. Now, the process, the strategy for dealing with these shared objectives, the principled ones and the realistic ones. There I don't see any difference in the objective. A slight nuance between Senator McCain and Senator Obama. There's not a big difference. The strategy for achieving it, though, I think is quite different. And I would name four things that are quite different. One, war is a last resort. Two, you use the full arsenal of American diplomacy. Three, you use multilateral institutions. We're not afraid of them. They can be our friend and our ally in leveraging American power abroad. They shouldn't be destroyed. And this is a very important thing to Senator Obama. He believes that it matters what people abroad think about our country. He believes that our reputation abroad is part of the arsenal, of the American arsenal, for doing good, not just for people abroad, but for doing good for the people of the United States. And that, I think, is if there's one part where I think that will be a fundamental change. Of course, the slogan is change. Change you can believe in. But if one thinks about what will radically change by electing Barack Obama as president versus the last 8 years, that is where we're going to get a big uptick, a big, big uptick in the way that the rest of the world looks at us. Now, we may not use it wisely should Senator Obama become President Obama. I don't know. It's hard to predict. But I do know it'll be a giant windfall that will be good for us if we do use it properly.
Thank you, gentlemen. Our thanks tonight to James Woolsey, a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, recently having moved to the Bay Area, a partner now at Vantage Point Venture Partners, specializing in renewable energy, and to Mike McFaul, a professor at Stanford University, and deputy director of the Freeman Spogli Institute and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution.
And I need to just add one correction to something Mike quite understandably said, but it's just not, in fact, the case. Out of a combination of nostalgia and stubbornness, I am still a Democrat. I am a devoted Scoop Jackson, Joe Lieberman Democrat, but I am a Democrat.
Well, we thank you, Mike, representing Senator
vote,
Senator
right?
Obama, Jim, representing Senator McCain. Thanks for your good humor here tonight, and also for your work for each of your candidates, which, of course, supports the democratic process in general. Thank you to our audience here in San Francisco. Thank you to our audience on the radio, television, and Internet. I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 105 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.